A couple of weeks ago, we saw how out of all the peoples in the world, God chose a man. He just, out of His pure divine grace, chose a man, a guy named Abram, and said, you know, I'm going to reveal myself to the world through you and through your descendants. And He called this man to a unique destiny, a destiny where God said, I'm going to bless you, and you're going to bless others. And through you, all peoples on earth are going to be blessed. And we saw that a couple of weeks ago, and then what we looked at last week was how God put things in place to help enable and prepare that people for this unique destiny. And we're going to continue in that vein today and talk about some more foundational things that God did to make that people prepared and able to fulfill that destiny, to continue that destiny, continue that calling that God gave to their forefather Abram. Now in our welcome session today, you see that the introductions question has to do with who has significantly impacted your faith walk and how. So take a little time right now, hit pause and think about that. Think about who has really impacted your faith walk. And I would suggest you may take a little extra step there and let that person know. Write them a note. Say something to them. Let them know how they've had an impact. It's amazing how many times you can have an impact on someone else's faith walk and never even know it. God works through us in many mysterious ways, in ways that we don't ever even know. So think about that. Also then, in the in-depth class, you know, go over your memory concepts, and then today we're having a little test in the in-depth class. So if you are in the in-depth class and listening to this at home, then you'll need to get test 3 from us and complete it. And it's a short one-page test, not like the multi-page test of test 2. I'll tell you, at least in the Old Testament, the odd tests are one-pagers and the even tests are big ones. There are 6 tests. There's, I guess actually a 7. There's a final. Sorry, but there is. Okay, well, let's do a little quick review, and we'll just review the pictures here. 2 weeks ago, we studied this study called Pronouncement of a Destiny, and this is the foundational hinge point lesson of Bethel. It's what Bethel kind of revolves around, and that is Genesis 12, 2-3, where God called Abram and said, go, I'm going to bless you, and you're going to be a blessing to others, and through you, all peoples on earth will be blessed. And we see that in this picture here. If you look at the picture for 2 weeks ago, study number 4, we look at it 2 different ways, and we see that shaft of light coming from heaven striking the prism, and that is the part where God says, I'm going to bless you. Okay? All blessings come from God. Just our life, our ability to live, everything is a blessing from God, purely out of His grace, out of His love for us. And then that light diffuses through this prism into through the figure. And so that reminds us the second part of that, where God says, I'm going to bless you, and you will be a blessing. Okay? And you will be a blessing. So we get involved in that blessing. And then that light continues on through the figure, on into the rest of the world. And that's the last part. And through you, all peoples on earth will be blessed. So just by looking at that light and the prism, how it disperses that light, we see that Genesis 12, 2-3. The foundational calling for Abram, the foundational calling for us. God calls us and says, I'm going to bless you. I've chosen you out of all people on earth. I'm going to bless you. And you'll be a blessing to others. And through you, I'm going to bless all peoples on earth. And we've talked about that. Then, another way to look at it is just the figure himself of Abram. Okay, take a look at his kneeling, his posture. Okay, for us to be receptive to the blessings and be able to put the blessings in motion so that we can be a blessing to others, and through us God can bless all peoples on earth, we need to follow Abram's example of a proper posture, of a worshipful attitude. When we look back at our story, we saw that when God told Abram to go, leave everything behind that you've known, all your family, your house, your home, everything, and go where you don't know where I'm telling you, but just follow me, he left. He went. He obeyed God and went. Okay? And everywhere he went, he worshiped God. He built altars. He praised God wherever he went. The worshipful attitude, the proper posture, this kneeling figure here. The next thing we see is him facing God, and that reminds us of the childlike trust that we're called to have. Abram trusted God. God told him that he was going to be the father of many nations, even though he was well past childbearing years, and his wife was too, and they didn't have any kids. But he believed God. He believed God that that land, all that land, everywhere he looked, north, south, east, and west, was going to belong to his descendants. Even though he didn't own any of it except for the small burial plot that he bought to bury Sarah. Abram trusted God. And that faith that Abram had was credited to him as righteousness. That's a faith that we're called to follow. A faith that we're called to live under, to be Abram's descendants by faith. Follow his example of childlike trust. And then the last thing we see is he's holding the prism. So that talks about action. And we're not just called to sit back and receive God's blessings, but we're called to put God's blessings into action. Be a blessing to others. Abram went. God called him. He went. Okay? Abram was told to circumcise himself and his household. He didn't think about it. Immediately, that same day, he did it. He was told to go and sacrifice, to kill his one and only son that he loved, that God had told him was going to be the channel through whom God was going to fulfill all these promises. And he did. He went and did that. God stopped him right at the end, but you see his faith in action. We're called to have a faith in action, to take the faith that God's given us and put it into action, to do his work so that as God blesses us, we can bless others. And as we come together as the community of God, as the body of Christ, through us, all peoples on earth can be blessed. Just as through the people of Abraham, all people have been blessed through the sending of Jesus Christ, God's Son, who brought salvation to all people. And then last week we saw that then as this man became a family, became a people, became a nation, that Israel, okay, the name of that chosen family, looked ahead to the dreams and the promises and the circumstances and the disciplines that made their future. And we looked at this ardent dreams of a destiny in last week. The figure sitting on the rock ledge here is Israel. And that ring encircling that figure reminds us that Israel was called to be separate, to be a chosen people set apart by God for a special purpose, for this special destiny. Okay? Set apart by God. We talked about how that means holy. Holy means to be set apart for special purposes. So Israel is called to be a holy nation. This figure looking off, surveying the scenes in the misty cloud, just talks about how Israel considered their promises, disciplines, and circumstances of the future that led to this destiny. The first thing we see on the bottom left is the land scene, and that reminds us that these promises included land. The specific land of Canaan, okay, the specific promised land that God had promised to them. The one in the middle is the covenant included the promise of descendants, many descendants that would become nations and kings. Up in the top, we then have this, what I'd call the separation scene, where you've got this ring again. Okay, and whenever we see that ring, it reminds us of separation. And we've got this ring encircling these small figures, this little family, okay, man, woman, and child. And that reminds us that Israel was called to maintain ethnic separation, separation from other peoples. And we saw examples of that. Whenever you had some inclusion of other peoples in the family, God separated that. You saw that with Hagar, the Egyptian handmaid. Okay, the Sarah Hagar situation. And God pulled Hagar and her son Ishmael away because that's not where the covenant was going. That was not the covenant family. You also saw that with the wives of the covenant family that Jacob chose, of Rachel and Leah, in contrast to the Hittite wives and the descendant of the granddaughter of Ishmael that Esau chose. Okay, so you've got different ethnicities involved that are not part of the covenant chosen family, and God separated those peoples from the covenant lineage. The other figure that we see that's up there that's not in that circle reminds us that God also brought separation within families. Okay, separation within the family to ensure the destiny. And as you go through the generations, you see that over and over again. You see that between Abraham and Lot. Okay, and how Lot was separated from Abraham. In the next generation, we see how Ishmael was separated, and because the covenant lineage was going to go through Isaac. Then in the next generation, we see how Esau was separated off because the covenant lineage was going to go through Jacob. Now then, we see the covenant then goes to all, but the greatest blessing of the covenant goes to Judah. Okay, out of the 12 sons of Israel, Judah is the one, and he's not the firstborn. In that culture, everything went to the firstborn. The firstborn got a double share of the inheritance. If you had three kids, your inheritance would not be divided by three, but rather be divided by four, and a double share would be given to the oldest, because the oldest was then also responsible for continuing the family and leading the family, and that gave them the resources to do that. But there was a double share, and the blessings of the father would go to the oldest son, and yet that was Reuben. And Reuben was not the chosen. The number two and number three, Simeon and Levi, they were not the chosen. Judah was way down number four. He was the chosen. And so you've got this separation within family. And actually, if you go backwards, Jacob wasn't the first. Esau was the firstborn. Right? Isaac wasn't the firstborn son of Abram. Ishmael was. Okay? So here you see God's choice is not necessarily man's choice. The next thing we see, if we look down, we see another one of those circles back down in the land scene, and that reminds us that Israel was called to be separate geographically as well. Okay, just the calling that God gave to Abram to leave Ur and to leave Haran and go to where God was going to show him. And God took him to Canaan and said, "This is going to be your place for your people, your descendants, to be and to reveal me to the world." That's the geographic separation. And then, as God took this family, the family of Israel, Jacob and his sons and grandsons, and took them down to Egypt to turn them into a nation, and we'll talk about that today, you've got this geographic separation from Canaan, getting away from all the Canaanites of that land, moving down to Goshen in Egypt, where you think, well, Egypt is such a populated land. How is that geographically separate? We're going to talk about that today. But what you see is they were settled in Goshen away from all the Egyptians in their own land, and they were separated geographically there. The last thing we see is the prism. Okay, that prism's all important because that's what all this is about. That prism reminds us that all these elements of Israel's dreams, the promises of land, the promises of descendants, the callings to be separate ethnically, within the families, geographically, all of that was there to enable and empower Israel to become the blessing that they've been prepared to do, to fulfill the destiny to which God had called them. That's our message last week. In our in-depth class, June Milligan's going to present what she learned about examples in the Bible where separation enabled someone to fulfill God's destiny for them, and some other examples where a lack of separation prevented someone from fulfilling God's desire for them. Okay, if you may want to think about that on your own too. Going on, some memory concept review. Now, these are the memory concepts that the standard class has had so far. And if you're in the in-depth class, I'd suggest, well, let's go through these. Now, I know you just had a test, but your test covered everything up through numbers. And, you know, the in-depth memory concepts, there's a whole lot in there. There's a bunch of them. The standard, there's not as many, and I think the ones that we find in the standard memory concepts are really the most important ones to make sure you know. Naturally, we don't write the tests, but the tests cover all of them. But let's just see how well you do on these two. Okay? Number one, the first one, God created all things good. Where do we find that? Genesis 1. Okay, very clear. God can use evil for good? Genesis 50. Also Romans 8:28, but that's another story. Blessed to be a blessing. Boy, if you don't know this one, you've got some making up to do. Genesis 12. That's Genesis 12, 2 to 3. You ought to be able to say the verses too. Deliberate ethnic separation. This is where Isaac chooses Rebekah. Genesis 24. Hagar and Ishmael. Okay, this is also a separation here. separation within family and ethnic separation, if you want to look at it both ways. Genesis 16. Okay, we have, it's kind of sandwiched between 15, which is the great covenant, the blood covenant that God institutes with Abram, and Genesis 17, where he institutes circumcision. You've got that story right in there in 16. Okay? Separation within families. This is Abram and Lot. Genesis 13, the chapter right after Abram's called in Genesis 12. Geographic separation in Goshen. Okay, well, this has to be back towards the end of Genesis, right? So somewhere around the very end, you know, there's 50 chapters in Genesis. So 47. 47 is the answer. Divine intentions. Ah, you should know this. We spent a lot of time on this. Genesis 2, God's divine intentions of perfect harmony. The flood. Genesis 7. 7 means complete, okay, to the Hebrew. And God did a complete washing of his creation. Completely restarted it, basically. Brother's keeper. Genesis 4, okay, remember we've got in Genesis 3 the fall, right? And so the very next chapter we then see the next big sin, okay, is murder, and that's what we have in Genesis 4. Tower of Babel, Genesis 11. I always remember the two ones there represent the sides of the skyscraper, okay? The fall, we just said that. That's number 3, okay? You got God created all things good, and then God's divine intentions in chapter 2, and then chapter 3 we see how we screwed that up with the fall. And then circumcision instituted, 17. We're going to look at that closer today. In Exodus, the first half, memory concepts, because you'll get more in your homework today if you're in Standard Bethel. The birth of Moses, Exodus 2. Okay, Exodus 1 talks about all the problems and the hardships of the people. And then we see chapter 2, God calls Moses. God brings Moses into the world. The excuses of Moses when faced with a challenge, or the way I like to put it is the 5 reasons that Moses gave why he was the wrong guy for the job. Chapter 4. Jethro's advice to Moses to delegate responsibility. This is a good one, and I'm not sure why I always remember this, but I do. It's Exodus 18. Israel, a kingdom of priests. 19. And the reason to help remember that is the very next one, which is the Ten Commandments, we find in Exodus 20. Okay, 20 is easy to remember because you've got 2 tablets, right, with 10 commandments. So 2 times 10 is 20. So Exodus 20, that's kind of a way I remember that. And so Israel being called as a kingdom of priests precedes the giving of that law. So that's why Exodus 19 is easy to remember there. The eye for an eye code. Okay, the eye for an eye code, this is some of the civil law. Exodus 21. We have God's moral law given in Exodus 20. Okay, there's 3 aspects of God's law. The moral law, the civil law, and ceremonial law. And then we have in the moral law, which is God's law to all people for all time. God's moral law never changes. It's the same today as it was 4,000 years ago. Then we have the civil law, which are the laws that God gave this new nation of Israel to kickstart it, to get them going. And so God gives those next, and so that's why Exodus 21 is easy to remember. And then the other type of law is the ceremonial law. Okay, how do we interact with God? And the ceremonial laws that God gave Israel we see largely in Leviticus. Okay, largely in Leviticus, but kind of scattered throughout as well. And those are laws that were a foreshadowing of what Jesus was going to do and how Jesus then fulfilled those. Okay. That's your memory concept. Well, let's dive in today, okay? Now we're moving into Exodus, okay? We're at the end of Genesis where the Israelites have moved to Egypt, and today we'll be getting into Exodus. So God gets His special people, His chosen people Israel, into Egypt. Why? Now Genesis 46, starting at verse 1. So Israel set out with all that was his. Okay, this is talking about Jacob. God had changed Jacob's name to Israel, which means he wrestles with God, which is also very symbolic of the people of Israel, okay, which is what Israel's or Jacob's descendants were called, and the new people of Israel, that is us, the Christians. Okay, so Israel set out with all that was his, and when he reached Beersheba, okay, which is a town in the southern part of Canaan. Okay, southern part of Israel. You're getting into the desert area at Beersheba. He offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the vision at night and said, "Jacob, Jacob, here I am," he replied. "I am God, the God of your father," he said. "Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I'll make you into a great nation there. I'll go down to Egypt with you, and I'll surely bring you back. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." So God here is talking to Israel, Jacob, as a person, but also Israel to Israel as a people, as a nation. They're not a nation yet, but they were going to become a nation. And God is talking to that nation. He tells Israel, he tells Jacob, "I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to go with you, and I'm going to bring you back. But I'm going to take you down there and turn you into a great nation." How could Israel become a great nation in the midst of all these Canaanites? They needed to be geographically separated somewhere so that they could grow into a great nation without all the distractions and influences of all the multiple gods of all the peoples around them. Okay? So God takes them down to Egypt. Now, Egypt, though, is a highly populous area, right? How could they achieve separation within that populous land of Egypt? Go back to chapter, or well, same chapter, but verses 31 through 34. Then Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, "I'm going to go up and speak to Pharaoh, and I'll say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who are living in the land of Canaan have come to me. The men are shepherds. They tend livestock, and they brought along their flocks and herds and everything they own. Or when Pharaoh calls you in and asks, "What's your occupation?" you should answer, "Your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our fathers did." Well, then you'll be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, for all shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians. So God made them herders, shepherds, okay, keeping flocks, keeping herds. And Goshen was a very lush, plush area, beautiful area, all watered by the Nile Delta, part of the Nile Delta, and great for raising livestock. But that was beneath the Egyptians. That was something that they had slaves do. They had other peoples do or whatever. And so Joseph said, "When you go before Pharaoh and he asks you what y'all do, you tell him that you're shepherds, okay? And then he's not going to want to settle y'all around all the people. He's going to put you off out into this land of Goshen where it is perfect for y'all. And there's not a lot of Egyptians there, okay? So that geographic separation then in Goshen, away from the heart of Egypt and all the Egyptian people, resulted also in ethnic separation to keep them from the influence of all the Egyptian gods and all. Now, what is significant about the quality of the land in Goshen? Chapter 47, verses 5 to 6. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come to you, and the land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and the brothers in the best part of the land. Let them live in Goshen. And if you know any among them with special ability, put them in charge of my own livestock." So the plushness of Goshen provided this place for them to be ethnically and geographically separate, but it also greatly blessed Israel. It was perfect land for the kind of lifestyle that these people lived as herders, okay, as keepers of flocks. And through that, God blessed them, and Israel was able to flourish. Now, how did God provide for the Israelites in Goshen? Because remember, they came down because there was a big famine going on. And that famine wasn't just in Canaan. Listen, 47, starting at verse 12. Joseph also provided for his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to the number of their children. There was no food, however, in the whole region because the famine was severe. Both Egypt and Canaan wasted away because of the famine. So while everyone else in the world, everyone else in Egypt and Canaan and the nations around there had no food and suffered as a result, the Israelites were blessed because the guy in charge of the food that had been stored up to help keep the nation going during these times of famine, he made sure that the family of Israel was fed, because he was part of that family. And then verse 27, now the Israelites settled in Egypt in the region of Goshen. They acquired property there and were fruitful and increased greatly in number. So they settled in Goshen, but they also ended up owning property. They acquired the property there. They had land now. They couldn't get kicked off of it. And they multiplied greatly. That many descendants is happening, just as God had promised to Abraham. Now, what part of God's promises to Abraham was especially completed and developed in Egypt? Now, I can tell you, it's not the land, the promise of the land, because that was not the promised land. Even though they acquired land in Goshen, that was not the promised land. That promised land was up in Canaan that God had continued to point out to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. But it was the other promise. Exodus 1, verses 6 to 7. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. So the promise of many descendants was developed there. Now, we don't see them turning into a nation yet. That's coming later. Okay, we'll talk about that in future weeks. But right now, that promise of many descendants is being fulfilled as they live in ethnic and geographic separation in the land of Goshen. Now, how much? Well, take a look. Let's compare. How many people left Canaan and came to Egypt? Genesis 46, verses 26 and 27. You can actually start at verse 8 if you want to and read about and get all the list of names, but you can see that all those who went to Egypt with Jacob, those who were his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives, numbered 66 persons. With the two sons who had been born to Joseph in Egypt, okay, also them counting Joseph, who is already in Egypt, and also counting Jacob, who was not numbered among his descendants, but was himself. So with those four added on to that 66, the members of Jacob's family, which were in Egypt then, were 70 in all. Okay, so 70. What kind of number is that? Seven is that big complete number, that total number to the Jews. And so this is 10 times. So 70, you see that magical number there. So 70 is what came down. Now, you know, they had servants and other peoples with them, but these are the ones that were part of that blood lineage of that covenant family. 70 of them. Well then, now what's interesting also, if you compare that with Genesis 10, in Genesis 10 we see what's called the Table of the Nations. And it talks about all the nations that descended from Noah. Okay, basically we're all descendants of Noah, right? All the other families besides Noah's family were wiped out in the flood. So we're all descendants of Noah. And Genesis 10 talks about how Noah's descendants became all these different nations. And if you count them, there's 70 of them. So there's 70 nations that descended from Noah. 70, all the peoples in the earth that lived at the time of Noah and thereafter were divided into 70 different peoples, right? Well, now we have 70 chosen people out of those 70 peoples of the world. Okay, just kind of a little connection there. So we got 70 there. Then how many belonged to the covenant family when they left Egypt 430 years later is how long that when they left? Turn to Exodus chapter 12, starting verse 37. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. 600,000 men. Well, if you figure wives and kids with that, and then it says other people went too. You're talking at least 2 million people. At least 2 million people from the 70 that had started 430 years earlier. Okay? So, just as God had promised, I'm going to make many descendants, more than you can count, and that continued to grow, that continued to go. Okay? Exodus 12 verse 40, if you read a couple verses later, you see that the length of time the Israelites people lived in Egypt was 430 years. That's where I get that 430. Now, if you take a look then, God does the part of expanding and taking this one man and turning him into millions of people and turn a nation. Now, I like a note that Pastor Kay had in his notes. He said, how do you take an individual who becomes a group, who becomes an organization, who becomes an institution, how do you take that to maintain the mission and identity of the original individual? How do you do that? You've got to have things that connect and unite those people together and to this common mission and calling and identity. So how does that then happen from Genesis 12 to Genesis 50? Can the people of Israel maintain the identity, maintain the mission, maintain the calling, maintain the destiny of Abram? What does God do to help ensure that? And that's what we see with our new picture. Okay, so take a look at the picture here. And these are what we see. If you look, you see this mortar bowls and pestles there. And if you think, if you take a bunch of different herbs and spices and whatever and put them in mortar bowls and grind them up, it all unites them together into one mixture, right? Well, these are reminding us that Israel was united into a people by specific experiences. So these are uniting factors that God put into place to unite this people so that they would continue to keep, recognize, remember, maintain, and follow that destiny, that mission, that calling that God had given to Abram for him and his descendants. So in what ways was Israel united for her destiny? Exodus 19, verses 5 to 7. This is God speaking here to Moses, and he says, "Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you'll be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now these are the words you're to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them the words that the Lord had commanded him to speak. So God says, "I have chosen you out of all people to be a kingdom of priests, to be a holy nation, a people set apart to reveal me to the rest of the world, to live the great life that I've got prepared for you." So God united them to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Okay, so there's a unifying factor there. In what ways is the new Israel? Okay, the new Israel is the New Testament Israel, us, Christians, okay, the body of Christ. How are we, as the new Israel, united for our destiny? Ephesians 4, verses 3 to 6. Paul says, "Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace." There's one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. What a great way to say that. We're all together with one peace and one body. There's one Spirit, there's one Lord, there's one hope, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father. Okay? One calling that God and Father works through each and every one of us individually and communally together. We, like the first Israel, are united for our destiny of being blessed to be a blessing, and through us, God can bless all peoples on earth. So, what are these uniting factors? What are some of the uniting factors that God put into place to ensure that they could fulfill their destiny, and that destiny would continue? Well, the first one we see in the upper left is this one with this sharp rock. The sharp rock. What's that? That reminds us of circumcision. Circumcision. Now let's talk about circumcision a little bit. Okay? This all takes place in Genesis. Okay, what's the memory concept? Genesis chapter 17. So let's look at that. First couple verses here. "When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, 'I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you, and I will greatly increase your numbers.'" So when Abram was 99 years old, he called Abram and reconfirmed his covenant. And if you look at the rest of the chapter, what you see him doing is he restates his promises, his promise of many descendants, his promises of the land. He also shows this by renaming Abram to Abraham. Instead of the Father is exalted, he changes his name to the Father of many. Okay, but he didn't have many kids yet, right? He had Ishmael, but Ishmael was not the covenant child. Okay, and God tells him that in chapter 17. He says, you're going to have a son, and you're going to call him Isaac, and he talks about that. And he also rechanges Sarai's name to Sarah. So here we see this covenant reestablished. Now, how does he establish it? And what is Abram's part and his descendants' part, his family's part of this covenant? Verse 9. God said, as for you, okay, God says, I'm going to do all this for you. I'm going to give you many descendants. I'm going to bless you to be a blessing, and through you all people on earth will be blessed. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to work through your descendants. And as for you, okay, this is what you got to do. You must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come. And this is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you're to keep. Okay, this is what you're to do. So what was it? Every male among you shall be circumcised. Every male among you shall be circumcised. What is that? What does that circumcised mean? Okay, well, we know what the act of circumcision is. We know what that entails. But what does it really mean? The word circumcised means to cut off, to separate. Abram and his descendants were called to be a separate, cut-off people. Okay? They were called to be a separate, cut-off people. And this circumcision was a sign then to remind them, an ever-present sign that was with them wherever they went, that reminded them that they were a separate, cut-off people. Okay? Now, which members of the covenant family were to be circumcised? Verse 12. For the generations to come, so not just now, not just your members of your family right now, but for all generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Okay? So, basically from birth, their whole life, they are to be circumcised, a separate cut-off people, including those born in your household or bought with money from a foreigner, those who are not of your offspring. Whether born in your household or bought with your money, they must be circumcised. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. This is to go on forever. So all males, all people in the family were to be circumcised, whether they were born in the family or bought as servants for the family. Now, other cultures, the Israelites were not the only ones who circumcised. Other cultures circumcised. The Egyptians did. Others as well. But in all other cultures that circumcised, circumcision was a mark indicating manhood. But not for the Israelites. The Israelites, circumcision was a mark indicating chosen by grace by God. Being chosen by God for this special, unique, holy, set apart, separated destiny, calling. Okay? So that's what we have here. This circumcision was instituted. Now, how important was it to be circumcised? Verse 14. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. Well, that sounds pretty harsh. Just because someone hasn't been physically circumcised, does that mean that they cannot be a part of this covenant family? Yeah, that's what that's saying. Why? Well, why wouldn't someone be circumcised? If they knew the covenant, which that was part of the covenant, is make sure that this continues on for all generations to follow. If they were not circumcised, it was because they refused to be circumcised. They refused to be part of God's covenant. And so that's what God's saying. If someone refuses to be part of my covenant, then they're not going to be part of my covenant. They won't receive all the blessings. They won't be part of this destiny to which I'm calling you and your descendants. Okay, so rejecting circumcision was a rejection of God's covenant. So what was, again, the purpose of circumcision? Verse 11, you are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. So this was the signature. This was the sign. This was something that they would always remember, a present reminder that God made these promises, that they were called for this unique destiny, okay, to fulfill this unique destiny of being blessed to be a blessing, and through these people, God would bless all people on earth. So, did this serve to unify the Israelites? Let's look at some examples. Genesis chapter 34. Okay, we won't read the whole thing, but we'll just pull one piece out of it. Verse 14. We've talked about this story before. They said to them, "We can't do such a thing. We cannot give our sister to a man who is not circumcised." Okay, this is the Dinah and the Shechemites incident. And this is Jacob's sons talking. And they said, "It would be a disgrace for our sister to marry an uncircumcised man. We're to be kept separate from others." Okay. Now here they were started focusing, and if you look at the story, they focused on the circumcision as the end in itself, rather than the sign reminding them that they're to remain ethnically separate. Okay. But this recognition that it would be a disgrace for people in the covenant family to marry uncircumcised people, that served to keep them ethnically separate. And then 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 26, this will sound as a familiar. This story is with Goliath out there taunting the Israelite army, you know, calling them dogs and threatening them and saying, "Oh, come on, you chickens, come get me," you know. And chapter 17, verse 26, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" So you see the disgrace, the disdain that David had. How dare an uncircumcised Philistine defy the armies of God? We got God on our side. This guy may look towering at 9 feet plus, but he's no match to our God. What about today? How was circumcision changed as a sign of the new covenant to which the new Israel, that is us, have been called to? Look at Romans 2, starting at verse 28. Paul says, "A man is not a Jew if he is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inwardly, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a man's praise is not from men, but from God." Okay? Circumcision is still required. If we want to be part of the covenant family and receive the promises and blessings that God has given to Abram and his descendants, we have to be circumcised, just as God commanded in Genesis 17. But what Paul says here, it's not circumcision in the flesh that's important, it's circumcision of the heart that's important. Each and every one of us being circumcised of the heart, by the Spirit. That's what's important. Now, did the recipients of the new covenant, as Christians, did the recipients of the new covenant understand this new sign? Look back in Acts 15, verse 1. "Some men came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the brothers, 'Unless you're circumcised,'" because in Antioch there were a lot of Christians who had been Gentiles, who had not been Jews. Whereas in Judea, they were pretty much all Jews who had become Christians. And so they had been circumcised. And so they go to this Gentile church in Antioch and say, "Unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved." So in other words, they're saying you've got to physically become a Jew before you can be a Christian. Right? Well, this brought Paul and Barnabas into a sharp dispute and debate with them. So Paul and Barnabas were appointed, along with some other believers, to go up to Jerusalem to see the apostles and elders about this question. So that was a big argument in the early church. In fact, it led to the big Jerusalem council, the first church council that we have a story of. And they looked at it and said, yeah, that's not the requirement. But that's what people were saying. Unless you're physically circumcised, you can't be saved. And that's not true. Rather, unless you're circumcised in the heart, you can't be saved. Now, you could say that. And how did Paul respond to this whole thing about circumcision being an end in itself, that you've got to be circumcised? That's the goal of circumcision, is to be circumcised, and you have to have that to be entered, versus a means to an end, which is what God instituted in Genesis 17 as a sign of His covenant, right? And the book of Galatians is written largely as Paul responding to the efforts of some of these Judaizers, people who are trying to take Gentile Christians and make them into Jews before they can be Christians. Paul condemns that over. That's what this book was largely written about. And so see what he said in some of it, starting verse 2 of chapter 5. Mark my words, I, Paul, tell you that if you let yourself be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he's obligated to obey the whole law. So if you're getting circumcised because you feel you have to do so to be saved, then you got to follow the whole law. All right? You who are trying to be justified by the law have been alienated from Christ. You've fallen away from grace because Christ fulfilled the law for you. There's nothing that you can do to save yourself by the law, right? Okay? We've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, so there's no way that we can save ourselves by the law. So if you're depending on the law to save you, if you're depending on circumcision to save you, then Christ is of no value to you, because what he's done, you're thrown out. You're saying that's not enough. That didn't do the job. But by faith, we eagerly await through the Spirit the righteousness for which we hope. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision, physical circumcision or uncircumcision, has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. So, circumcision has no value unless you're under the law. And if you're under the law, then the grace that God brought through Jesus Christ has no value. But what does matter is trusting God, having faith in Jesus Christ. That is all you need. Okay? So that's the first uniting factor, is that circumcision, that sharp rock there. Okay, the next one we see, let's go way down to the opposite side, and we see that circle again, right? That blue ring, what does that remind us of? Separation. Okay, we talked a lot about separation last week. And what did separation help unite them? Let's look at Leviticus 20, verse 26. You are to be holy to me, because I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the nations to be my own. All of these elements of separation, ethnic separation, separation within family, geographical separation, all of this separation was part of the theme of God calling them to be a separate people, set apart, holy, to be God's own people. Because God is a separate, set apart, holy God. There's no other God like him. He's the only God. So this separation, they were all together called to be separate. Okay, it sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. And by that common calling to be separate, they were separate together. And that was a uniting factor. Okay. Now, the next one over, we see this throne and behind that land. So you got this land and the throne. And that reminds us of what we talked about last week. All these common hopes and dreams that Israel had for the future of how God was going to bless them to be a blessing, okay, through the promises of land, through the promises of nations coming from them. Genesis 48, starting at verse 3. Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me, and he said to me, I'm going to make you fruitful, and I will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of peoples, and I will give this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you. And then in chapter 49, we see that Jacob called his sons and said, gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. So Israel is dreaming about that future, of God fulfilling that destiny to and through Israel. And that is a uniting factor. They shared that common calling, that common blessing, that common promises. Okay. Numbers 6, verse 27. So they will put my name on the Israelites, and I will bless them. These will be to be a people, the people, with God's name on them. Okay. He put his name on them. They would be blessed. And I will bless you so that you will be a blessing, and through you all peoples on earth will be blessed. We see that scattered throughout, but look at Isaiah 9. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You've enlarged the nation. Okay, just like you promised. You've increased their joy. You've blessed us greatly. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the days of Midian's defeat, you've shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be a fuel for the fire. Why? For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders just like he promised. And he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. God will continue to bless us so that we can be a blessing, and through us, all peoples on earth will be blessed. Okay? God's promises continue on. This is hundreds of years later, and we see his promises continuing on. How uniting is that? All these promises united the people. Right? Next, up towards the top, we see the pestle with the yoke on it. And that reminds us of this oppression under Pharaoh. Okay? That was a uniting factor. In fact, that was part of God's plan. Take a look back at Genesis 15. Okay? When God is talking to Abram, when God makes this blood covenant with Abram, and we haven't had a chance to talk about that much in this class, but after Bethel's done, when we go into Bible stories for adults, there's a class that gets into this blood covenant relationship here. But Genesis 15, verses 13 to 16, the Lord said to Abram, "Now know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country that's not their own, and they'll be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I'll punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward, they'll come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sins of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." So God had told Abram that your descendants are going to be enslaved for 400 years, but then I'm going to bring them back. And I'm going to bring them back with great wealth, and they'll be a great nation. Okay? And I'm going to give them this land at that time. So God made these promises way back to Abram. So, how did that happen? How did that happen in Egypt? Exodus 1, starting at verse 8. "Then a new king, who didn't know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to the people, the Israelites have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they'll become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. And they worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. And in all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly." So we see this oppression, this enslavement. They became slaves. They were treated harshly, not just enslaved to have to work, but they were treated harshly because the Egyptians feared them and wanted to weaken them as much as they could. But the more they tried to do so, the more God strengthened them. Now, why was it important that the Israelites endure hardship in Egypt? Now look at chapter 3, verse 7. "The Lord said to Moses, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, the home that I promised to your forefathers," right? "And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way that the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." So why was oppression part of the plan? Why did God allow oppression to happen? Because if they lived in that land of Goshen, in the lush, beautiful land of Goshen, where everything was perfect for them, Why would they want to leave? Their destiny involved going to this promised land, the land of Canaan. And God says, as good as Goshen might be, I got this better place for you. A land flowing with milk and honey. A land that I've prepared for you. It's a land that belongs to Canaanites and Perizzites and Hittites and Hivites and all these otherites, the Etzeterites. Okay? And if without that oppression, without that pain and suffering, they wouldn't want to leave. So God allowed that. We see that also in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 1 verses 25 through 27. I will turn my hand against you. I will thoroughly purge away your dross and remove all your impurities. I will restore your judges as in days of old, your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward, you'll be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Zion will be redeemed with justice, her penitent ones with righteousness. So we see that God allows oppression, troubles, to purify his people. He says, it will purge away your dross and remove all your impurities. Okay? So God allows oppression to come into our lives even. Think of the times when you felt closest to God. How often are those times difficult, painful times where you cannot stand on your own two feet without God's help? Okay, when things are going well, we think, oh, hey, look what I'm doing, and look at me, and this is all great for me. But it's those times when we realize that, no, we can't do it, that we're called back to God, that we come back to God. Okay? And so God allowed that oppression so that they would look to God, call out to God, and then want to follow Him when that time came. Okay? So oppression was a uniting factor. Next, down at the bottom right, we see this pestle with the tablets, the law symbol. Okay? And this reminds us that the laws that God gave them, the moral law, the civil law, the ceremonial laws that God gave them were uniting factors. Okay? The prime one is the moral law. We see Exodus chapter 20. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Now you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day, it's a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son nor daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that belongs to your neighbor. There we have the Ten Commandments. There we have the law, God's moral law, placed before the people. A law that has continued to this day because it's a law that's timeless. A law that continues on forever. This is God's moral law. And then to that, he added his civil laws that helped kickstart this new nation of Israel. He also added his ceremonial laws that talked about how they were to relate with him. And then in response to that, chapter 24, verse 3, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice. Everything the Lord has said, we will do. How uniting is that? They came together under a common set of laws, and they together said, everything that God has said, we will do that. One more thing on this picture. One more thing. And what is that? Look in the middle. You've got the prism. And to remind us what that prism says, you got the words, I will bless you that you will be a blessing. all of these uniting factors were put in place, the circumcision, the separation, the land and the promises of land and descendants, the law, the oppression, all of those were there to unite Israel, to be able to enable them, to empower them to fulfill their destiny of being a blessing. Israel's united destiny was to be a blessing. Genesis 12, 2 to 3. Okay. Before long, you ought to be able to just recite this by heart. I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and curse whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. That promise was given to Abram. It's given to his descendants by birth, the Israelites, and his descendants by faith, the new Israel, us. God says, I will bless you. You will be a blessing by you. All people on earth will be blessed. Isaiah 2, verses 1 to 3. This is what Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It'll be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many people will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So many will come to Israel. Many other peoples, all peoples on earth, will come to Israel to seek the Lord and to seek his ways. Why? Because God has revealed himself to the world through this people. God has brought salvation to the world through this people. God has blessed this people so that they could be a blessing, and through them, all peoples on earth can be blessed. Okay, one last verse here in Zechariah, chapter 8, starting at verse 20. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Many peoples and the inhabitants of many cities will yet come. And the inhabitants of one city will go to another and say, let's go at once to entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty. I myself am going. And many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem and seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat them. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, 10 men from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, hey, let's go with you, because we've heard that God is with you. God has revealed himself to the world through this people. God has blessed all peoples on earth through the blessings he's given this people so that they in turn can be blessings. God has called us. He has blessed us so that we can be a blessing, and through us, he can bless all peoples on earth as we take the message of salvation to all people, the message that he brought to us through his son, Jesus Christ. Okay? So these uniting factors enabled the first Israel, the Old Testament Israel, to fulfill the destiny to which God called them. Okay, we see that in this picture. The mortar, bowl, and pestles remind us that Israel was united into a people by specific experiences. The pestle with the sharp rock reminds us that circumcision was one of those uniting factors. Okay, a sign that they were a cut-off, separate people. The blue ring, that whole separation, calling to be separate ethnically, within families, and geographically, was a uniting factor, united them together. The pestle with the land and the throne, the promises, the common hopes and dreams, and the promises that God gave these people was a uniting factor. The pestle with the yoke up top, the oppression under Pharaoh, was a uniting factor. The pestle with the law symbol, the laws that God gave them, the laws received at Mount Sinai, were a uniting factor. And the prism in the middle reminds us that Israel's destiny was to be a blessing. All these uniting factors were put into place in order that they might fulfill their destiny of being blessed to be a blessing. Okay? Now we'll invite someone in the in-depth class to do a little research project this week to find some examples in the New Testament, how the New Testament Israel has uniting factors similar to those of the Old Testament Israel. Okay? Be an interesting exercise, so you might want to just consider doing that on your own too. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, oh, we thank and praise you for the way that you think about us and shower your love on us, that you're so concerned about us that you you could have done things in so many ways, but yet you took great care that all the world might hear about and see and be called into saving grace through what you did through your Son Jesus Christ. You did that by calling this people and revealing yourself to us and to the world through this people. The stories that we have of this people in the Old Testament reveal you to us in great detail. And you reveal us yourself to us through that, but you also fulfilled your promises to us, to them, to the world by sending your Son Jesus Christ into this world to save all people from their sin. And you've likewise called us, you've blessed us to be a blessing so that we can take that message forward to others. And just as you've united the original Israel to enable them to be the fulfill the destiny to which you've called them, you've also united us into one body, one Lord, one faith, one baptism into the body of Christ. We thank and praise you for your grace in calling us into that body and the power of your Spirit that you give us to keep us in that body by faith. We pray this in the name of your beautiful Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.